This piece is brought to you in conjunction with the Food Book Fair. The Food Book Fair is supported by Squarespace.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So before we get into the show, I want to get a little something off my chest. I went to the premiere of Farmland last week. Farmland is a movie that profiles six farmers from across the country trying to bring light to the issues facing agriculture today. And I really went into the film with no preconceived notions. I wasn't really sure what it was going to be about. And I'm always a hypercritical consumer of these things. So as I'm sitting through the film, I'm thinking, you know, I'm really wanting to like be like, no, they're getting it wrong. But what I felt myself thinking was, wow, they're really touching on some interesting issues that I never see covered in any kind of popular media form about farming. I was particularly impressed by, they really got the message across of, you know, farming being a business. They touched a lot on the kind of difficulties of farm transition, you know, moving a farm from one generation to the next, and farms as family businesses that are dynamic and include challenges like, you know, imagine your entire life working with your mom or your dad or your sisters and brothers, living with them, living next to them. There's a lot that's amazing about that, and there's a lot that's super challenging. I also thought they put a really great light on large-scale farmers. I feel so often in the media there's this kind of us-them language. Large-scale producers are often incredibly demonized, and I think that this doesn't do service to our movement. It keeps them removed from us. It keeps them other. And what I really think we need to be doing is creating more spaces for all the current stakeholders in food production to be coming to the table. I really thought the film fell short with regards to animal welfare coverage. You know, there wasn't really a pasture-based alternative. You know, they talked about organics, they talked about commodities, they talked about CSA farming. But when it came to kind of the animal welfare, they really only focused on confinement operations. And I thought that was definitely a weakness in the film. And then, you know, the film breaks and we go out to the reception and I find myself talking to the film's funders. That's the Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. And I was talking to the chair of their board and I'm like, well, who sits on the alliance? And it's the National Pork Producers and the National Soybean Farmers and the National Corn Farmers. And immediately alarm bells go off in my head. And I'm like, whoa, did I just get totally hoodwinked? Did I just watch a really well done advertisement for commodity farming? And I couldn't quite tell. And I still can't quite tell. And I'm hopeful that people will go out and watch the film and react to it, people on both sides of the food production aisle, and that hopefully, I think success would really look like, in this case, sparking a real conversation about, you know, what's happening in agriculture today. I just wanted to share that. I want to put out a call for feedback. I would love for folks to send me their thoughts on the film and their response to my response. Definitely shoot an email. It's just Aaron@heritageradionetwork.org. And with that, we're going to tuck in to the rest of the show. All right. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to the Farm Report, and I'm your host, Aaron Fairbanks. And today, we are on the line with Scott Chasky. Scott is a poet, farmer, and educator, and we're going to talk a little bit about his new book, Seed Time, on the History, Husbandry, Politics, and Promise of Seeds, and a little bit about his upcoming talk at the Food Book Fair, which is happening next weekend. Scott's talk is going to be on Sunday, April 27th. So definitely, if we whet your appetite, get your tickets at www.foodbookfair.com. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hi, Aaron. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So I have to ask, you know, what prompted the book? You know, why seeds? Why a book? Why now?
Well, I did write. I've been working in community supported agriculture for, well, this is our 25th year at this farm, Quail Hill Farm, and I did write a book previously called This Common Ground, and it was really about the experience of starting as a gardener and finding community farming, and about the growing movement of community supported agriculture around the country. And I was ready to write another book, and it sort of was an organic process. I mean, it came out of the seeds that I handled daily for the last 30 years. And when I started writing it, I had slightly different focus, but when I realized what a vast subject it was and how intensely important it was right at this moment, that sort of led me further into the research, and therefore I wound up spending time on the history and the politics, as well as the magic of seeds, which is what I started with, basically.
And you definitely touch on all those subjects throughout the book. I want to, before we kind of continue, can you tell us a little bit about Quail Hill Farm? Now, you're out in Amagansett, New York, and you're working the land for the Peconic Land Trust. So for folks who aren't familiar with the farm, can you just give us a little bit of a lay of the land, so to speak?
Yeah, I can certainly do that. I'm looking out at the beech woods as we speak. And so we're on a 220-acre preserve, preserved by the Peconic Land Trust. And I'm actually a sort of a rare breed. I'm a salaried farmer. I work for the conservation organization, the Peconic Land Trust. And the Peconic Land Trust has preserved or conserved about 10,000 acres of land on the east end of Long Island, and 25 years ago, we created something unusual. At that time, we were the only ones doing it in the country. Since then, other people are trying experiments of the same sort of combination, which is a marriage of a conservation organization and a community farm. So the CSA got going 2 years before it arrived here at Quail Hill. And we're in Amagansett, for those who don't know. It's the last stop before Montauk. So we're, 85 miles out from New York City. And we created this marriage between the conservation organization and the community farm, and we've run it for 25 years. The unusual thing about this particular farm is that most CSAs deliver to pickup sites or, bring produce into the city, but our members actually come 2 days a week and harvest all their own food.
Wow, that's so you're getting a little labor along with your food.
Yes, I mean, if you look at it as a cooperative, we're all in it together, and the farmer's job is to, do the ordering and the planting and the major cultivating and all that sort of thing, and the member's job is to actually do the harvesting.
So for your talk at the Food Book Fair, you guys are going to be looking at food farming and scale, kind of thinking in particular about organic food and how to make it accessible at a larger scale. And I want to talk a little bit today about something in that kind of same area, these ideas of scale. And when I'm thinking about seeds and the way that we use them and save them and buy and sell them, particularly in the U.S., it's changed a lot in the not too distant past. And I want to talk a little bit about kind of who have been winners and who have been losers in that transition, and get a little bit of a sense of who the kind of stakeholders are. And if maybe you can paint a little bit in broad strokes of the kind of picture of the changing arena of seeds in this country.
Well, the if you're talking about losers and winners, I mean, the losers are really all of us, because as Carrie Fowler put it, we're in a mass extinction event. We're witnessing a mass extinction event in agriculture, and that's the loss of biodiversity. And what we need, what we all need, is a greater resource, a more diverse resource of seeds, which are really the foundation of agriculture. And I like Vandana Shiva's phrase, which she repeats often, which is seed freedom. And we need the opposite of what has become the industrial agriculture paradigm, which is to patent seeds and to halt the free exchange, the free flow of seeds. And what we need is the opposite. We need a greater flow of seeds between people and between farmers and nations, etc. And we need to create more biodiversity, not to demean it. And so that's sort of where we are. It's, as I said before, it's such a vast subject. I mean, you know, when you get into the subject of hybrids, I mean, that which began, you know, early in the 20th century, the hybridization process, there's nothing inherently wrong in that, and we use hybrid seeds on this farm as well, but what's happened is that the open pollinated seed supply has diminished incredibly. So what we really need to do is focus upon building up the open pollinated population, and farmer to farmer, and you know, state to state, nation to nation, that sort of thing. And then, of course, you get into the subject of genetic engineering, and that's a whole nother realm. Anyhow, it's a big topic.
Let's
see where we go next.
Let's tuck into some of those areas a little bit. So the shift towards hybrids happened for a reason. And my understanding is that the way it was sold to farmers, the way that was sold, you know, vis-a-vis farmers to consumers, is you're going to get greater yields.
Yes, and more reliability. So when you're looking for certain traits, for whatever reason, there's something called hybrid vigor, which puts new life into a variety for 1 year only, because the problem there is that you can't reliably save the seeds of hybrids. So then the farmer is then forced into a relationship with a seed company, and that's, you know, could be a problem and could not be. It's mostly is a problem. So that's one angle. And then there's a further angle of control from the seed company. The basics, you know, when you get into genetic engineering, so really the basis of the whole thing is that less and less control is in the hands of the farmer and more in control of larger corporations.
And farmers essentially were willing at some point to give up this control in exchange for increased yields, in exchange for producing a greater volume of crops. And my sense is that if we're thinking in this kind of context of like winners, losers, that like and the different types of stakeholders, is that changes over time as kind of the realities of the exchange become more and more clear, and then we start, I think, losing things and losing this seed heritage, losing these different species as we become more and more dependent on fewer and fewer sources to purchase our seeds. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, no, that's right. No, you're right. And really, when we're talking about, you know, when I was talking about biodiversity, of course, I'm talking about natural diversity, but we need all kinds of diversity, you know, and so that, you know, when we're talking about seed purveyors, you know, we need more and more seed purveyors. And in the book, the promise of, you know, which is part of the subtitle, the promise is really the work that's going on sort of grassroots around this country outside of the land grants, who have largely given up on, there's just a revival now in the land grants, which is sort of exciting, but you know, the organic process of farmers teaching other farmers and a few, you know, brilliant breeders going into the whole, putting energy and time and resources into breeding the open pollinated varieties, because that hasn't happened in the last 50 years or so. So there's a couple of great people, John Navazio out west and Frank Morton, who are working on educating new breeders farmers and farmers in, you know, the ancient art, which is mostly gotten lost. So that's really what we've lost, the art of saving seed, which used to be something quite common.
And we need
to bring it back.
Yes, I would say something that just was the way, there was no alternative way to do things.
That's true.
So,
that's true. That's how things went for about 9,750 years. You know, So
the change we're talking about has happened in the scale and the scope of agriculture incredibly quickly.
Very, very quickly, and that's not, you know, I mean, that's how things happen in an age that embraces technology in the way that we have. But an important thing to remember is that, you know, agriculture is practiced throughout the world, and in other parts of the world, it's still done quite differently than it is in this country. We've been very good at exporting, you know, one way of doing things, but perhaps we should take a look at learning from, you know, the techniques which have been, you know, serving mankind quite well for thousands and thousands of years. So I mean, when you look at when you're talking about scale, we don't hear very often. What we hear is that, you know, we've got to produce more food to feed the world, and that's sort of on our plate, as they say. But you know, 70% of the world's food is actually produced by small farmers. Not many people hear that kind of statistic. We usually hear the others. So.
Well, you said something earlier that I want to come back to with regards to land-grant colleges, and this was something I thought that kind of popped out to me at the beginning part of your book, where you're talking about the institutional frameworks that are supporting a particular type of production, and you mentioned land-grant colleges, and you mentioned industrial ag, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what you mean by that, what that means for you.
Well, the land-grant, you know, institutions were created in the late 19th century to basically to serve farmers. And I think I quoted in the beginning of the book that one of the main focuses of the land-grants originally was to hand out seed to farmers, which was actually free. So the sort of organic grassroots process was actually part of the mission of the land grant universities, and of course that changed gradually over a number of years. And the linkages now with land grants, although there's lots of good work being done at land grants, and I have a great relationship with our local Cornell Extension, everything. But largely the links as far as research go have to do with industrial ag, with the land grants, and that's a very sort of disturbing process. That process.
So essentially, the educational institutes that were designed initially to serve and be a resource for farmers are now being a resource for a very small group of farmers.
Yeah. That's the dominant paradigm. I do want to mention that there's lots of good work and you know, quite a few good people working for the land grants who I'm very thankful for too. But the general pattern, we hope, you know, it needs some shifting. And let's hope that we can really, really can make that happen in the next 20 years or so.
Well, I was speaking with a seed farmer out in Missouri earlier today who, you know, he produces on contract, you know, he grows corn, seed for corn and seed for soy. And we're talking a lot about how that transition for him on his farm, he went from a very diversified farm over his lifetime to producing seed on contract. And I'm just curious, you know, what do you say to those farmers who are farming in the middle, who have been, you know, kind of getting squeezed? Mm-hmm. It feels like on both sides, they don't really fit necessarily into the niche local mm-hmm. market. You know, they've been farming professionally in their family for generations. Mm-hmm. You know, they've inherited a way of life, a mindset. How do we open that conversation up?
Well, that's a good question. How did your conversation go with that farmer? I'm curious. You know, it really mostly comes down to education, and we have to, you know, we have to continue to understand from our past. You know, so once what happens is that, you know, it's this thing, it's called a progress trap. I quoted this from a friend of mine, Tom Wessels, who talked about the progress trap, that once you've gone down a certain road, it's very hard to go back. But, you know, there's ways of getting back or not going too deeply down that one road. So there are multiple ways to open up the conversations. The most important thing is that the conversations have to happen among many people, and there has to be a recognition of that there is not only one way of doing things, basically.
Yeah, and I think, too, you touch on that also in the book, kind of the danger, both the danger and the gifts of technology. So, you know, I don't think anyone is advocating that we go back to a time where we're, you know, plowing fields with, you know, a horse or oxen, and that, you know, there is a certain amount of, like, shift that's happened in agriculture that I think on scale we're quite thankful for, both from a labor component of not having to do certain types of things or as much of them, but also from a, you know, I don't know. It's like it's not anti-technology, but there is technology with care. So I wonder, how do we think about innovation? What questions do we need to be asking? Who can we trust in that, in those conversations, as we're seeing these things evolve and being told, hey, we have to feed the world here. You know, the world is growing. Like that, I feel like, is always the kind of thing that gets put back onto this conversation that I have a hard time answering that.
Yeah, no, I know, and that's the, when I've been reading from this book, and people, you know, the two questions that people keep asking are, you know, what do we do in the face of, you know, the mammoth industry that is the ruling force right now, and then what can I do individually? You know, I mean, those are the things that people keep asking, and that's sort of where we are in the world, and we're all kind of aware of that. What I would point to is the extraordinary the amount of young people who are so incredibly excited about, you know, learning ways of taking care of the soil and taking care of the earth. And I, you know, we used to have to sort of look around everywhere to find someone to join us in the work we were doing, and now it's just extraordinary, the people that come to us. And it's not just this one farm, it's happening all around the country, I know, because I've traveled around and talked to lots of people. And I think we have to go to that generation who can actually help to lead us in a place that, you know, the older generation can't quite see. I think, you know, I think it's bubbling up is what I'm trying to say. And again, that's what I see as the promise. I don't think we have to be stuck or feel that we're stuck, because you know, the error would be to continually claim that there's one magic bullet which is going to help us to do this thing, you know, which we're calling feed the world. But there's an awful lot of people who are willing to be there to innovate and to help us get there.
I kind of on a similar note. One of the chapters I really like the way you talked about burdock root and and this idea that looking at burdock and that being an inspiration possibly for the creation of Velcro, and this kind of brought this other kind of thing to me, that by looking very closely and thinking very deeply about growing food and food production and seeds, that we may find unexpected inspiration for other things. And I wonder if you could share a little bit about that burdock story for our listeners.
Yeah, because, so with the one thing about burdock, I think I started off talking about tenacity, and so I was claiming that burdock, which is, for those who don't know, is a very deep root, much deeper than a carrot. But so what I like is the index to my book actually has a under T, it begins with tenacity of farmers, and I like that the index maker came up with that. So burdock is the most tenacious of roots, and one of the stories was that I've forgotten his name right now, but he was out for a walk with his dog, and he came back, and they were covered with the burrs, which are, you know, part of the burdock plant. And then he for some reason put it under a microscope, and he found this sort of the hook pattern of the actual burr, which makes it stick to you. And this is, of course, what nature invented to, you know, to take the seed, you know, to spread the seed. And he got the idea of creating Velcro out of those burrs that came out of the burdock. It's such a great story, and it comes from one of the most tenacious of plants. And I don't know, I view that as a kind of tenacity that someone was able to, you know, not swear at all these burrs and throw them away, but instead put it under a microscope and then, you know, found something transformative out of that, basically.
Yeah, taking a second look, and I think that's what I so enjoyed about the book is that all the kind of the vignettes, the stories of seeds, and the kind of anthropomorphize. You didn't give this, the seeds almost felt like like alive with conscience in a way, and strategy for propagation.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that, so the title Seed Time, I derive from from Wordsworth. Fair seed time had my soul is the phrase from Wordsworth. But the seed time that I was implying at, you know, throughout the whole book is really the sort of magical realm that seeds give us, and that it's so much a part. Our the world that we know has been given to us by the angiosperms, and who, you know, are the seed bearing plants, and it's so extraordinary to look at the whole realm of that I was hoping that the title Seed Time would you know, give that to people.
Well, Scott, we are going to take just a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the importance of seeds in the face of our ever-changing climate. So hang tight. We'll be back after a short break.
Okay, thank you.
In her garden, an old pair of jeans, and she smiled at the sun and the pale olive trees. She wiped the dirt from her hands as she stood up to leave. And the earth opened up, and she was taken from me.
This show is brought to you in conjunction with the Food Book Fair. The Food Book Fair brings together food enthusiasts, chefs, artists, writers, designers, and publishers to celebrate the intersection between food culture and food systems. The Food Book Fair is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. Squarespace includes beautifully designed, customizable templates, drag-and-drop tools, e-commerce, and 24/7 support. Start a trial with no credit card required. When you decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code FBF14 to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for Heritage Radio Network. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website.
And we're back. You're tuned into the Farm Report. I'm your host, Aaron Fairbanks, and we are on the line with Scott Chasky talking about his new book, Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and premise of seeds. So I know that one of the main arguments that we hear about why it's important to protect biodiversity and protect the diversity of seeds is because we don't know the future. We don't know the kind of resources that we're going to need as regards to climate change or disease. And can you talk a little bit about what role seeds can play in the face of a shifting climate?
Well, simply stated, we just need to encourage diversity. So the more varieties that we can experiment with that will lead us in that direction, which means training more people to breed varieties that will be able to adapt to the climate that's changing constantly. And the research has been going in the opposite direction. So basically, we have to reverse that and conduct more research that will, give us plants that will be able to adapt. And there's a much the greater genetic variety that we can encourage, the more adaptation will be possible. Basically.
And why look to seeds? Why not look to the lab? Why not create our kind of perfect, plant?
Well, because nature is wiser. there's nothing wrong with work going on in the laboratory, and we've been manipulating plants for thousands upon thousands of years. In fact, the lab work that's going on in a place like the Land Institute with Wes Jackson is something that we really need. He's trying to, if people don't know about the work he's doing, he's trying to create a perennial wheat and perennial grains, which will replace the annuals, which he sees as the greatest problem of agriculture. So we do need that work, but we also need to work within systems. We need to understand the natural systems and to constantly work within them if we want to have plants that will be able and understand, how plants will be able to adapt to the changes in those systems.
One of the things I always find a little perplexing or is challenging for me when I'm thinking in particular about genetically modified seeds and plants in that realm is that there's a lot of really smart people investing in that technology. And I think most particularly about Bill and Melinda Gates. And I'm wondering, how do you make sense of that?
I don't make a lot of sense of that, to be quite honest. I don't know. That makes no sense to me because the magic bullet approach, that one technology will, be the solution has never worked. We saw it happen with the Green Revolution, and that was proclaimed as the greatest. The greatest invention that would, feed the world, and that didn't work. And it's not no single approach like that will. It's just not the way natural systems, operate. And I don't, some of those solutions just catch the eye and the ear of people who are willing to invest for perfectly good reasons, I do understand that part of it. However, a much broader approach is what we need, and that's that, basically.
Well, I want to kind of shift a little bit into a slightly more delicious area and talk a little bit about garlic, because you devote a whole chapter in your book to garlic.
Okay.
So, why? What is it about this? What is it about this that was so worthy of so much space for you? If you can share with us.
I actually have said, I wonder if I can write a book that doesn't have garlic in it. it just happens to be my favorite crop, and I love planting it. And I don't know. I this is sort of you know, what any gardener or a grower, you know, you find something that leads you deeper into an understanding of all the processes that you're working with soil and temperature and all forms of weather and the plant life itself. And I love the taste of garlic, so it starts with that, and I cook with it every day. And then I love the process of learning about it 8 months of the year, because that's how long it's in the ground. So it's sort of an unusual plant. You plant it in the autumn, and it overwinters, and it doesn't actually form the bulb until the following June, and then you harvest it in July. So you get to know it quite well. So it's something somewhat in between an annual and a perennial. And I suppose, you know, people who love trees or one particular type of tree feel the same thing when they come to some understanding where they're closer to the, you know, what interconnects us with the entire natural world. And I guess I get that from garlic. Glad you brought it. It is a delicious topic. I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, and to me, I guess there's some things I'm always, you know, I always think of this. I can't even remember who the quote was from, but they're talking about, you know, people ride around in cars all the time and have really no idea how that works, like how an engine works on a really fundamental level. There's so many things in life that you experience on a daily basis that, you know, I don't stop to question. And I think garlic was one of them. And I think what jumped out at me about that chapter, aside from your obvious love for it, was thinking that, like, a garlic seed and a garlic clove are essentially one and the same. I was surprised by that. So for folks who maybe were in a similar position to me, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about how one cultivates or saves garlic seed.
Yeah, so you basically, you plant one clove. So say the type of garlic that we plant is called a hardneck variety, and it puts out this beautiful thing called the scape. And if people have not seen that, I would encourage them to go look at a farm that grows hardneck garlic, because it's so beautiful when these scapes come out, and it's a sort of twirly. It's called a flower stalk, which is not really accurate because it doesn't really form a flower at the end the way other allium plants like onions do. So garlic really produces vegetatively, and the way that a daffodil bulb or a narcissi bulb does. So you plant one clove, and you know, you have to separate the bulb, obviously, in the autumn, just before you're planting. You plant one clove, and, you know, a magical thing happens. It actually clones itself, is what it does. That process takes, you know, as I said, about 8 months for it to do that, and it, you know, simply clones onto itself, and from one clove planted, you get five or six in the type of garlic that we grow, many softneck garlics. You get smaller cloves. You might get anywhere from 10 to 15. So, again, it's quite a magical process to see. The amazing thing about, you know, so we plant about 750 pounds of garlic and yearly, and that's about 45,000 cloves. So all of them, one by one, you know, hand seeded. So that's what we refer to as seed. It's, you know, technically a vegetative clove.
Well, Scott, we are unfortunately out of time, but it's been a real pleasure chatting with you, and it was really lovely to get a chance to take a look through and read some of your book. And I would definitely encourage folks who are New York City located to hear more from him. Again, he'll be speaking on a panel on organic food and scale and scope at the Food Book Fair on April 27th, and you can get tickets by visiting www.foodbookfair.com, and you can find Scott's book wherever fine books are sold. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for being on the show today.
Yeah, well, it's been a treat to be on the show with you on my birthday.
Oh, well, happy birthday. I had no idea.
I'm so happy that we ended with garlic.
We may have like a garlic cake or something, you know.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much. And thanks for everyone for tuning in.
Okay.
This show, like all 35 of our live weekly shows, are available for free through Stitcher or iTunes. You can also find them by visiting our website where all of our shows are archived. It's www.heritageradionetwork.org. We are a member-supported organization, so if you believe in what we do, please support us by clicking that Donate tab and becoming a member today. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.